Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half, as we yet again bring a Christian and a non-Christian together here on the show that aims to bring both sides into discussion. We aim to do discussion on all kinds of areas: theology, apologetics, faith, ethics, history, Bible interpretation, and much more, all part of the range of programming we try to bring you every Saturday afternoon, helping you to think through your faith on Faith Explored. If you want to find out more about the show, more about all the things that you can look at in terms of special features, subscribing to the podcast, and so on, then do go to the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's got links, of course, to our Facebook and Twitter accounts, so you can follow me if you really want to, and find out more about what goes on in my average week. Today on the show, though, I've got a fascinating discussion for you on heaven. Let me tell you what's coming up.
You're unbelievable.
Well, we're asking today, are heaven and hell religious inventions to control people? Is there any evidence for the afterlife? And would an atheist want to go to heaven anyway? We've got an atheist and Christian discussion on heaven today. It's because Christian thinker Randall Rouser has authored a new book, What on Earth Do We Know About Heaven? And he's in this discussion today with Hemant Mehta. He blogs as The Friendly Atheist online. He's been on the show a couple of times, as has Randall in the past, but Hemant once sold his soul on eBay to the highest paying Christian. He came on several years ago to talk about that. Perhaps we'll revisit that subject as well. But why doesn't Hemant believe in a soul, ultimately, that exists beyond death? Well, we're going to be finding out all about the different perspectives of my guests here on Unbelievable today. First of all, Randall, thank you very much for joining me on the program today.
Good to be with you, Justin.
It's great to have you on. Randall, you are a sort of Christian philosopher. You teach at a seminary in Alberta in Canada. You seem to produce a lot of books as well. There always seems to be a new title coming out. What made you want to write about heaven in this instance?
Well, I think there's a lot of books on heaven out there. Sadly, most of them probably aren't very good. There's a lot of books that are exploring sort of first-person accounts of visiting heaven, and often those books tend to shoot up the bestseller list. But their theology and the evidence for them is of dubious quality in most cases. There's also a few books out there that are of high quality on heaven, but they're quite academic in nature, and I was trying to go down between the middle there and have something that could appeal to people, but also is philosophically and theologically rigorous.
So you mentioned that there are a lot of books that have been going up the bestseller list. Heaven is for Real, I think, is one of them. I think it's due to be made into a film as well. These sort of near-death experience type accounts. What do you make of this then? Why the interest, and what do you actually think about some of these stories that have been making these bestseller lists?
Well, as a Christian, of course, I'm open to near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. I do think, however, that we shouldn't just be accepting everything that comes along the line simply because it might concord with our worldview. Heaven is for Real is a good example of that. It tells the story of Colton Burpo when he was 3 years old. He allegedly had an out-of-body experience and visited heaven. I looked at that case fairly closely, and I mean, I have to say, coming away from it, there was the theology in there was pretty problematic. For instance, he describes everybody as having wings and having halos, which is really pop culture rather than theology. And in addition, I mean, it just appears to me the most plausible explanation of that case is that this young boy, he was given suggestive leading questions by his parents unintentionally, and he began to tell tales as at the time he was four, as a four-year-old might do. So I don't find it to be a very strong evidential case for heaven.
But you do get people who claim that there are sort of details that people experience in near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, which they couldn't have known while they were in some kind of coma state or their heart had stopped or whatever. Do you rate them all in the category of dubious, or do you think there is something to some of these stories?
Well, that's a good point. So if you want to assess the quality of a claim, if somebody just says, I went to God, saw God in heaven and talked with him, it's pretty tough to falsify that. What you do want to look for, as you said, is veridical evidence, information this person couldn't have known otherwise. Now, in the case of Heaven is for Real, the boy, Colton Burpo, gives a few lines of evidence that he possibly couldn't have known otherwise. He comes back, he says that he has another sister, and he did, in fact, have another sibling. His mother had miscarried, and he had never known that. So there were a few lines of evidence like that, but I don't find it particularly strong, particularly, I mean, if you look at it in the whole context of what the book is claiming. But I do think we need to keep an open mind.
So beyond those kinds of experiences, is there any evidence that you would speak of for Heaven, or is it something that, as far as you're concerned, is revealed and taken on faith by Christians through Scripture?
Well, it would mean what we... maybe I'll reform the question. Is there evidence for an afterlife, for life continuing on after death? And I think if you look at it that way, you can find a whole range of potential evidences. For example, you can look at the failure of reductive, naturalistic accounts of the human person by looking at evidence for the fact that the human mind is not reducible to the human brain, that there's a spiritual part of a person, a unity of consciousness, which is not simply, again, reducible to the brain and brain states. You can look at evidence for near-death experiences and the kind of veridical evidence that you mentioned. And in fact, there are over 65 major studies on near-death experiences. And some of these are very powerful veridical evidence. So I do think all of that can provide a cumulative case for an argument for the afterlife.
Now, what we'll do is look a bit further on, sort of look at some of the actual things you want to write about in this book, and sort of you do some really interesting thought experiments on what the Christian view of heaven might actually look like in some sense. And I found it fascinating to read through some of your chapters on, you know, kind of, I guess, getting actually to what the Bible actually claims heaven will be like, rather than what often the culture kind of has in mind, if you like, for what heaven will be. But before we do that, let's bring in at this point Hemant Mehta, who is the friendly atheist online. He joins us. He was last with us, I think, back in 2012, talking to Leah Labresco about her conversion to Catholicism. She was an online atheist blogger, now a Christian. But Hemant, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with me.
Thank you, Justin. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on again. Hemant, you first kind of came to public attention when you wrote a book called I Sold My Soul on eBay. Do you think you actually have a soul to sell? Presumably as an atheist, you don't actually. That was sort of a tongue-in-cheek title.
It was tongue-in-cheek, and long story short, I basically said I would visit churches for the first time in my life, and I put that up for auction. And the media kind of changed that storyline to I sold my soul. and it was funny because you're right. I don't believe in a soul. I don't believe we have a soul. I think that's just a conception we all have. So that was a little strange. But, you know, when I ended up writing a book about that experience, it was too catchy of a phrase to not use as the title.
Bearing that in mind, have you ever harbored any thoughts or suspicions that there might be an afterlife of any kind, or is it just never struck you as something that's plausible?
Oh, I did, but then I turned 14 and I grew out of it.
You grew out of it. I mean, is that to say that you simply believed on the basis of what other people told you up to that point?
Right. It was part of my religion growing up. But then when you look for the evidence, and I'm very curious what Randall's evidence is here. When I look for that evidence, it just seemed, oh, maybe that's just a story we tell ourselves, because it does give us something to look forward to. It gives us hope, you know, and, you know, the worst thing in life is probably is death. And here's a wonderful story that says, no, that's not the end of everything. I mean, it's very optimistic. I completely understand why people would believe it.
Okay. And in that sense, would you like for there to be a heaven?
I don't think I would. I think I live with the knowledge that I'm only here for like a blink in the universe's existence, and I need to make the most of it while I have this amazing opportunity. I think the idea that we are immortal, or we could be immortal, it kind of cheapens that in some way. So, and plus the idea of heaven where you live forever, where you look over people for the rest of eternity. I mean, it honestly doesn't sound very pleasant. So I have yet to hear a conception of heaven that honestly describes something I would want to do for all time. You know, it's one of those things. Every time I hear a good description of heaven, it sounds like something that would be very nice for, you know, a day, maybe a year, but not forever.
Okay, that's an interesting point of view. Be interesting to come back on that, I'm sure. I wonder what you think about this. We're talking about heaven today on the program. Atheist and Christian join me today to discuss it. Randall Rouser is the author of a new book, What on Earth Do We Know About Heaven?, in discussion with atheist Hemant Mehta today. If you want to contact the show, as ever, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, if you'd like to email your thoughts in. And you can Facebook and Twitter us as well. That's @UnbelievableJB. If you're a Twitterer, you can find us on Facebook as well by looking for Unbelievable, and we'd be happy to get your comments in. Don't forget, of course, we've got some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme to the last few weeks of programming.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're talking about heaven. When you came to research this book, Randall, do you think as much as maybe opening a conversation with someone like Hemant, who's an atheist, doesn't believe in heaven anyway, do you think that there's some misconceptions among Christians that need to be cleared up as well?
Yeah, I should say that the nature of the book is not that it sets out to argue a skeptic of the existence of an afterlife, mm-hmm. but rather to clarify what a Christian should properly understand the afterlife to be, and then to explore some interesting philosophical explorations of it. And I do think that there is a lot of misunderstanding along those lines. I distinguish in the book, there's these two main views of the afterlife in the Christian tradition. You've got the otherworldly view, and you've got the this-worldly view. And the otherworldly view, at a popular level, it conveys a sense of heaven as clouds, ethereal harps, halos, something very different from this world. At an academic level, it is construed in terms of what we call the beatific vision, or just a timeless vision of God where you leave material change behind. I think that the more proper theological view, a view that's rooted in the Hebrew understanding of the afterlife, is a view that maintains continuity with this world, but this world brought to perfection. And so I think that brings a very different view of heaven, and frankly, I find it to be one that's much more palatable. When I grew up, I couldn't get particularly excited about heaven, thinking of it as the negation of all that is most wonderful about the creation God has made. Mm. To think of heaven as the perfection of creation, as God bringing creation to fulfillment, that is something I can get excited about.
I mean, you're very much, I think, in line with people like N.T. Wright, for instance, who has very much been a champion of the idea of a renewed creation as being what the Bible describes as the kingdom of heaven, and that we aren't to sort of look for some kind of spiritual evacuation from planet Earth. Rather, we're to look for the renewing of the planet that we have our feet on, etc. But we've often had those songs about, you know, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through, you know, that somehow heaven is a different dimension, a spiritual reality, not part of this earthly dimension. So do you think we've kind of, that kind of theology has got it badly wrong as far as the Bible's concerned?
Well, I think it's got it badly wrong. And by the way, I liked your Larry Norman lyric there. I remember that one well. I think it has it wrong, and I think it has a lot of negative implications, too. One of the implications, for example, is a sort of lackadaisical apathy about environmental crisis in the world. I remember one person, I was telling them, in the next century, the current projections are there will be 1 billion climate refugees in the world. And this person's response was, don't you think the world's just getting tired out? The idea being that God will just save us out of this world to another ethereal existence. So, I mean, ideas have consequences. And if you think that God is just going to crumple up this world and throw it in the trash basket, then there's a greater likelihood that you will live as if that's true and you will be less engaged in this world.
It's a really interesting point, actually. Hemant, as an atheist, do you think the Christian view of heaven, whether it's Randall's or another one, has been a damaging thing? I mean, you say that you think it cheapens in some way our experience of life to say that, well, this is just preparation for the big show that's coming next.
Well, I think it's probably, I mean, for most people who definitely don't think about any of this stuff academically, like Randall does, certainly, I think for most people it's a pleasant concept, because if they know if they're old, if they're going through a really fatal sickness, I don't see any real harm in them believing that they may be going somewhere better. It makes the end of their life more endurable in some way. So I'm not going to begrudge them that. So I don't think it's harmful in that sense. But when you were talking about how heaven could be damaging, I agree with Randall. Like, climate change is a perfect example of, or environmental issues is a perfect example of how those beliefs could have serious consequences. And of course, we haven't even talked about like fundamentalist extremists in some religions, where they believe that they are doing something for the sake of their religion, like bombing someplace, being a martyr, because they believe the heaven is waiting for them after they die. I mean, that's damaging on the extreme level.
Yeah.
This idea that there are things that could be used for bad or could be an incentive to do something bad, but at the same time, it could give people something to live for. It could give them hope. I mean, that's kind of religion in a nutshell, isn't it?
Sure, sure. I mean, what about, you know, those who say, well, heaven and hell have been used as a sort of divine carrot and stick by the religious authorities to basically get people to do what they want? Is that something you would say is true in history?
It's Santa Claus for adults. It's you want to do something good so you'll be rewarded later, and if you're bad, there's a punishment waiting for you. And it does worry me that people are saying, I mean, if anyone does say, I'm doing something good because I want to go to heaven, that kind of makes me worry, because in that case, I'm glad you believe in that stuff, because I don't know, I try to do good in this life even without the possibility of an afterlife.
Just be interested in your thoughts on that, Randall. Is that the way Christians do view heaven, as a sort of prize for being a good person, basically?
Well, I'm less concerned with how particular Christians think about these issues than how they ought to think about these issues. I'm sure that there are Christians who have had unhealthy understandings of the afterlife, just as there are atheists who have unhealthy understandings of particular things. And I think one thing I just want to highlight, I think from Hemant, that I've been hearing, is a sort of unchallenged assumption of projectionism. Simply because a particular person finds a view to be attractive, that therefore the view is just a psychological projection on behalf of that person. That's an unchallenged assumption, and of course it cuts both ways. If Hemant says he doesn't want to go to heaven, well then why isn't that just as likely a projection of his own preferred view of the afterlife?
Well, I could say I want to go to heaven. I don't think that changes the reality of the situation. And the people who say they want to go to heaven, they believe in heaven, again, I don't think they ever look at I don't think they're ever thinking about what heaven really is. I think if you ask them to describe heaven, they would just describe everything they love in their life, and they would just have more of that, you know?
I think that's a great start, though, for understanding what the afterlife is like. But I'm still going to stick to the point that the very argument you're trying to use against Christians just turns back on you, because you've explicitly said you don't want there to be a heaven. So then that would lead one to conclude, well, then maybe you're just projecting your own hopes on what the afterlife will be like, which is cessation of existence.
Saying I want to go there or not go, heaven could be the most wonderful place in the world, and it could actually exist. It has no bearing on whether or not. I think you're missing the idea that just because I might want to go, or some people may want to go, or I don't want to go, has nothing to do with whether or not this is actually there. We're talking about, we're arguing about the color of like a unicorn's horn here. It doesn't matter what I think the color is. The question is whether or not it's actually there.
Mm. Sure, sure.
Well, I agree with that for sure.
Yeah, I guess his point there was Hemant, that your suggestion that people kind of belief in heaven is a psychological projection of their desires could equally be turned around and said your non-belief in heaven is a projection of your desire that there be no heaven. But what's important is, well, is there any evidence that there is a heaven or not beyond our desire, individual desires and projections and so on. Now, in a sense, Randall, you've said you haven't set out to objectively prove an afterlife in this book. You've sought more to clear up how Christians should think about the afterlife. And so in that sense, I appreciate you're not here to kind of try and give Hemant a sort of objective evidence for the existence of heaven. But do you think Hemant has some misconceptions about heaven that you would like to clear up in the process? I mean, this idea, for instance, that there are, you know, Christians, for instance, are doing good because they want to go to heaven. Is that your experience? Is that the way heaven operates in your view?
There may be people who think that way. I think the way we ought to think is that heaven and hell are just simply natural outcomes for the way people choose to live their lives. Nobody is going to get to heaven because they work their way in and do enough good things. They find their way in heaven because they've entered into right relationship with God through Jesus Christ and developed the kinds of virtues that flow naturally out of that, becoming ultimately in eternity sanctified, glorified people. I mean, C.S. Lewis talked about this, that the sexual intimacy of marriage should not be the reason for getting married, but it is a natural outcome of marriage. It's nothing wrong with that. I would like to talk about the issue of evidence. I mean, that
sure.
Since I'm with an atheist, that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
So, I mean, one way to think about this, first of all, is you know, heaven becomes more or less plausible relative to background beliefs. I think there are excellent grounds to believe that God exists, good evidences to believe that God exists. So once you believe that God exists, that in and of itself makes it much more plausible that this is not all there is, that there would be an afterlife. I think there's good evidence that Jesus rose from the dead, and as Paul understood, Jesus is the first fruits of the resurrection. So once again, I think that, in fact, the resurrection is the model, in my understanding, not only for our future life in eternity, but for the very creation itself, that it will be resurrected to perfection. So again, that becomes more plausible if you believe there has been a person resurrected in history. And I do think that Hemant's statement that when he was 14, he just outgrew belief in the afterlife seems to me a little bit condescending. Like I said, there are literally more than 70 studies of near-death experiences that have appeared in peer-reviewed academic journals like The Lancet and Psychiatry, which are careful studies of people who give reports of near-death experiences. Jeffrey Long collects several thousand of them and wrote a book on it called Evidence of the Afterlife. And some of these include veridical evidence of out-of-body experiences, information that people could not have known otherwise.
Okay, so for you, given that you believe there is, you know, on the balance of it, a good objective evidence for the existence of God, that makes the possibility of an afterlife more likely rather than less likely. Obviously, Hemant probably disagrees with you on the evidence for the existence of God, and so correspondingly the evidence for an afterlife is correspondingly goes down. Now,
and it's also worth pointing out that we're also talking about two different things, neither of which I believe, and Randall's right about that, but there's a difference between there being an afterlife and there being the Christian version of the afterlife, which, as Randall just said, if you need to believe in Jesus to get into that one, that means most of the world is automatically doomed to suffer for all of eternity. And, I mean, if you're a Christian and you believe that, let's put that up front, that you believe everyone who's not a Christian is going to hell. I think that's a disturbing thought in and of itself.
Okay, Randall?
Yeah, that's incorrect. That's not my view. I'm an inclusivist. I don't take the view that one has to have a cognitive confession of Christ in this life to be saved by Christ. And I'm also a hopeful universalist, so I hope that ultimately all will be reconciled to Christ, and I think that's perfectly consistent with the Christian tradition.
That's interesting to hear, because obviously, as a inclusivist, as a hopeful universalist, your view then is that Christ is still the one who will bring everybody into that kingdom, if you like, but that presumably that raises the question of, well, if Hemant, for instance, says, I'd rather not be there, presumably no one's going to force him to be there.
Yeah, let me give you an illustration, because I run up against Christian exclusivists all the time who are quite confident that you have to confess belief in Jesus in this life to be saved by him. So here's an example. A young Jewish girl growing up in Nazi Germany, the only Christianity she's ever known is that of the Nazis, who declare her a Christ killer. She ultimately is executed in 1944 in a concentration camp at the age of 12, explicitly rejecting faith in Jesus, because the only Jesus she's known was the Jesus of the Third Reich. Is she going to hell? And I would find anybody who would declare the state of her eternal soul based on that evidence, that is just an extraordinary offensive statement. So I would be very hopeful, if not confident, that she could one day be reconciled to God.
Now, that's probably somewhat more palatable to you, presumably, Hemant, than the view you gave.
Anyone who says someone like Anne Frank is going to hell, I think that's a question a lot of Christians have to grapple with. And at some point, if they think about this stuff, I mean, they have to make a decision one way or the other. If you believe, like Randall says, and you're an exclusivist, then Anne Frank went to hell. Mahatma Gandhi went to hell, despite anything good that they may have done in their lives, or as innocent as they may have been of anything in their lives. And I would at least hope, for the sake of, I guess, humanity, that they believe that if you are a good person like they were, and you did nothing wrong in the cosmic sense, that that you would not be suffering for just not accepting Jesus. That strikes me as just a crazy belief to hold.
Sure. Well, it's obviously not the belief that Randall does hold. Randall, though...
Right. I would love to know if Randall has an answer for this. How many Christians are exclusivists versus inclusivists?
I would have no idea in terms of statistics. I think at a popular level, you are more likely to encounter exclusivism, say, among an evangelical population. But sure, there have been inclusivists going back to the second century of the church. And of course, depending on who you ask, inclusivism is or is not to be found in the Bible.
Let's take a quick break, gents, we're going to come back to this issue. We're getting theological today with an atheist and a Christian talking about heaven and a bit about hell as well. We're talking with Randall Rouser, author of a new book, What on Earth Do We Know About Heaven? He's in discussion with the friendly atheist Hemant Mehta. So come back again in a moment's time. This is Unbelievable, the place where we aim to get the conversations going between Christians and non-Christians. I'm Justin Brierley. Join me again in a moment.
Challenging, stimulating, and highly respected. Book your place now for Cambridge Summer Schools 2014. Theology, the Unity of Scripture with Dr. Walter Kaiser. A Biblical Approach to Counseling with Dr. Richard Winter. Apologetics in Contemporary Culture with Dr. Ted Turnow. From June the 30th to July the 18th, 2014. Book before February the 28th and save 10%. Visit christianheritage.org.uk/summerschools.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable, where we aim to get Christians and non-Christians talking. We're talking about heaven on the programme today, and if you've got a view on that and you'd like to get in touch with anything you hear about today's show, and you're welcome to agree or disagree with both the Christian and atheist guest on this programme, then get in touch, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Randall Rouser is a Christian thinker, author of a new book, What on Earth Do We Know About Heaven? He sort of teases out some of the philosophical implications of what it would mean to live in a renewed earth, a renewed universe, in the Christian view of heaven. He believes that is the biblical view of heaven. And we'll maybe talk about that a little bit as we continue this conversation with Hemant Mehta as well, the friendly atheist. Hemant, I mean, but rather than go too far down in the sort of chasing the theological ends of whether we're inclusivists, exclusivists, universalists, and so on, I mean, one thing that I always wonder is, well, if an atheist were given the option of heaven, would they say yes to that? I mean, I can think, for instance, of Christopher Hitchens. I think he said, heaven is a place of endless praise and adoration, limitless abnegation and objection of self, a celestial North Korea. So he was basically saying, if there is a heaven, I don't want to be there. What's your take on this, Hemant?
I mean, the first answer is, look, if it actually existed, of course I would want to be there. It's great. I mean, it sounds great. but it's a silly question to begin with, because I mean, I'd love to win the lottery too, but it's not going to happen. So why waste time thinking about that when it's just, it's a silly question to begin with? But no, I mean, if the choice, and by the way, there is really, what's the choice here for the afterlife? It's either heaven or hell, or whatever else you may believe in, purgatory-wise or something, I guess. But, I mean, obviously, given those two choices, I want to go to heaven. But it just strikes me as a strange question because, you know, either it's there or it's not. It wouldn't be a decision to really make.
Okay. What's your take on that then, Randall?
Well, I think I'll focus on Hemet's choice of wording, calling particular views of other people as silly.
Because well, it seems inconsistent. Silly.
Well, it seems inconsistent with being a friendly atheist, and let me explain why. Because everybody has what we call a plausibility structure. We all have sets of background beliefs through which we process and assess evidence. When you call something silly, you're merely saying, relative to my plausibility structure, that isn't within that structure. That's merely a comment on your own psychology. There's nothing more to it. And so I don't find that to be very helpful. It's just alienating.
Well, what would be a better word to use to say whether you believe in Allah or Zeus or something? Because I suspect you don't believe in those. So how would you say those things? Do you not believe in them?
Yeah, so I don't believe in Zeus or Muhammad or, sorry, Allah. But I don't go around saying that belief in Allah is silly.
Well, at some point, someone has to say the emperor has no clothes. So that's all I'm doing. I don't believe in this stuff. There's no evidence for this stuff. Let's talk about
that. That has to be a claim based on evidence. If you want to say the emperor has no clothes. And okay, if you want to say the emperor has no clothes, that there's objectively no evidence for, let's say, a dualist position for the survival of the soul from the body, then please provide that evidence. But don't just sit there based upon your own worldview declaring other people silly. What's the evidence?
It's silly when people believe in things without that evidence.
What is the evidence?
I don't believe that evidence is there.
Okay, no, but then you have to provide other evidence because you can be an agnostic about the afterlife, but you're clearly not being an agnostic. You're being an atheist. You're denying there's an afterlife. You have a positive claim of evidence, and now you have to defend that claim.
Well, you don't believe in like nine circles of hell, but I don't have to go around knocking each circle of hell down for you not to believe in that.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that you've said the idea of an afterlife is silly. So I'm saying that's a positive evidence claim. Please provide
the
evidence.
If you told me you believe in unicorns, I'm going to call that silly too, because it is, and I don't have to go around explaining.
I mean, it sounds to me, if I can just interrupt for a moment, that Hemant, what you're saying is, okay, well, regardless of maybe whether you're using the right terminology, sure, saying silly, but your non-belief in heaven is based on absence of evidence, as far as you're concerned.
And that's fair.
And so for you, absence of evidence is evidence of absence, let's say. Now, Randall, my guess is you have a view on whether that is a satisfactory argument.
Well, I find, first of all, no evidence that Hemet has even looked at the evidence for near-death experiences, that he has read in depth. If he has looked at the work of people like Michael Sabom or Steve Miller or Jeffrey Long, but I would also add that, again, he has a position. If he wants to defend the claim that there is no evidence, then he has to demonstrate that all the evidence is spurious. He's not even trying to do that. He's simply making an observation based upon his own plausibility structure.
Again, if you want me to list all the species of unicorn, and I think you would find it a strange thing for me to say, why don't you debunk every single one of these species that I throw your way? That seems like a frivolous activity that no rational person would be doing.
Great. Let's consider the disanalogy between unicorns and near-death experiences. There are not over 65 major studies studying unicorns which have appeared in peer-reviewed academic journals.
Well, okay. So that's a fair point. Let's talk about, to be clear, we are talking about near-death experiences, certainly not the Christian idea of heaven and clouds and God and halos, like you said. Certainly all those books that talk about, I went to heaven and, hey, look, it was just like the Bible said. Those are very different things, and we're dismissing that completely here. We're just talking about this idea that there may be more to life than just a physical world. I just want to make sure we're talking about the same things here.
What we're talking about is whether there is an afterlife or not. That's the conversation right now. You've declared it you've stipulated it's silly, so I've said please defend.
I do think it's silly. I do think it's silly. Now, I do not, you're right, I don't do that. I haven't looked at all these peer-reviewed things. By all means, let's send them, and I'll be happy to get back to you at some point. But this idea that that heaven is, the Christians have the right idea of what heaven is, and all the other millions of religions that have their own conceptions of what the afterlife is wrong, to say that they're wrong just because, I don't know what the reason is that you think they're wrong, I'd love to hear that too.
Okay, well, let Randall, okay, given that you do believe in heaven, why do you believe the Christian view of heaven is the correct view, and that when you die, you're not going to be in the Hindu version or the Buddhist or Islamic version?
Well, I mean, I believe in the Christian view because I'm a Christian, just like Hemet believes in his naturalistic view because he's a naturalist. Let me say something, maybe change the conversation a little bit. I do think it's a fair point that not all the evidence, certainly in near-death experiences, is directly supportive of Christianity. I mean, it falsifies naturalism. That doesn't mean it supports Christianity. So often, for example, you'll have people report back that they had a sense of the love of God. It was unconditional, that God said you can do no wrong. And those kinds of claims are inconsistent with Christianity, or at least would seem to be, where, yes, there are things you can do wrong. You can be alienated from God. And another interesting line of evidence that rarely comes up in these conversations is evidence for reincarnation. Now, I don't believe in reincarnation, but Ian Stevenson was a researcher at the University of Virginia for 40 years, collected documentary evidence, trying to provide evidence for reincarnation. And it's social scientific research, which is at least worth considering. So we shouldn't simply consider the evidence that supports our worldview, whether we are Christians or atheists or anyone else. At the very least, all this evidence seems to falsify naturalism.
Let me ask a question of Randall. I'm just wondering, since you might know this answer, all the people who have these near-death experiences, do we know what their religious views were or non-religious views were before they had these experiences? Like, do their afterlife claims back up pretty much what they believed beforehand? Or were any of them like, no, I'm a hardcore atheist. Oh, I just had a near-death experience, and I believe in Jesus now, or something like that.
Well, you do get a range. You get some people that have experiences which support their prior religious beliefs. You have other people who have experiences that totally disconfirm their beliefs. Michael Sabom gives an example of a man who had an experience of hell, of some kind of torment after life, and he was an atheist, and he ended up changing his life based upon that experience. Probably the most well-known example in that regard is A.J. Eyre, who was arguably the most famous philosopher in Britain, certainly the most famous atheistic philosopher in Britain. And in 1988, he had a near-death experience, and he wrote a famous article called What I Saw When I Was Dead. And he described seeing a sort of reddish light and getting a sense that this light was responsible for the governance of the universe. And that led him to qualify his own beliefs about the afterlife. He didn't become a Christian or a Hare Krishna or anything else, but he did say that this experience has slightly weakened his conviction that death is the end of existence.
It's interesting to hear that. I mean, I do want to get back to this question, though, that I asked at the outset, and I don't feel has quite been answered yet, which is, Hemant, okay, let's say that, you know, you crossed, you know, death, and you found out, oh, there is a heaven, there is a God. And my question is, would you want to go there? Because you say you would, but then the way that Randall certainly describes heaven and the Christian view of heaven is that it is, as it were, everyone is under the kingship of Jesus. It is about, as it were, submitting yourself to the reign of the king. That is what, in a sense, the kingdom of God is. Now, given that you've been happy to reject any notion of God in your life, is there any reason why you'd want to subject yourself to it in the afterlife?
No, that sounds, I mean, you're describing hell. I mean, if I don't believe in stuff, look, if I died and I realized I was wrong, then heaven sounds fine. Because, hey, if I'm wrong, then I should get under Jesus's reign or something. But I don't think I am. And what happens to people who are not Christian in this worldview at that point? You know, where, if you're a Hindu, if you're a devout Muslim, and you die, I mean, I don't know why you would want to go there given that description of heaven.
Okay.
But again, it's a silly question only because it seems like we're just assuming that the Christian version of heaven is the only one that makes any sense, and everyone else just kind of has to bow down to that. What would hell be like if that's what heaven's like? I'm curious, you know? For anyone who's not a Christian, it sounds like both options are pretty awful.
Randall.
Well, look, if Buddhism is true, and the way that you escape suffering is through the Eightfold Path, and then you achieve nirvana when you finally abandon all of your desires, then I want to know that, and I'm fully on board with living as if that's true, and I want to attain nirvana and become one with the universe. So, I mean, if Christianity is true, then you should want to be in relationship with God through Jesus Christ, because that's just what it is to be
true. I agree,
but
we're saying if you don't find out about this until you are dead, then what? Because there's a difference between believing Christianity is true during your life and living your life accordingly so that you can be with God in the afterlife versus you were devout, but you weren't of the right faith. And then you died and now, oh, hey, now what do you do? You know, it seems like bad options for everyone who's not a Christian. And heaven doesn't seem like a very pleasant place to be if you're not Christian. But then again, if you're dead, and you realize Christianity was true, it doesn't really matter now anyway, does it? Because,
well, I already did answer that by saying that there are people like myself who are inclusivists, that it is a 2,000-year-old
right.
tradition. It's as long as old as the church. How about, I'll come back to the whole question of boredom in eternity.
I think that is a good issue, actually. Would you want to go to a heaven where basically it goes on forever and ever? I mean, some people have suggested, you know, well, if heaven is like a Christian praise party but that goes on into eternity, well, that could actually get quite annoying after a while. You wouldn't necessarily.
As if church services weren't eternal enough as is.
but again, are we suffering a sort of faulty concept of what this heaven is as far as you're concerned, Randall?
I should say Mark Twain gave this famous point on this issue where he said Christians say they want to go to heaven, but they can't sit through an hour of church a week, and yet heaven is supposed to be an eternal church service. So there's an incongruity there. I agree. I mean, I grew up, one of my images of heaven was like an eternal Pentecostal praise meeting, because that's what I grew up in. And while it was okay for an hour, you get a little tired after a few billion years. But if you understand heaven as creation being brought to fruition and fulfillment, if you understand heaven not as the cessation of time and change, but rather as ongoing development, culture building, deepening of relationship, then I don't see any reason to think that that would be boring. If we think that God is omnipotent and infinitely good, there is infinitely enough that God can provide us for eternity to grow in knowing him and each other. I think one other thing I'll come to is Hemet mentioned earlier, one of the reasons he is negative toward heaven is if it goes on forever, it takes out the joy of finite life. You know, that we only have life for a season and so on. I mean, I can somewhat resonate with that, but I also find that my relationships now, for instance, my father is turning 80 this year. My whole relationship with him is also conditioned by the specter of mortality, that one day in probably the natural order of things, he's going to go before I will. And I have a sadness. There's a certain melancholy knowing that I will one day lose my father. So I have a very different perspective. I think if I thought, yeah, I would not have to be separated from my father, we could continue to deepen our relationship for eternity. I don't find that to be a bad thought at all.
Not a bad thought, but certainly it's one that you want to believe is true. I mean, you want to, that, and that's kind of what I was referring to earlier. It's one of these ideas that, of course, we want to see our loved ones after we die, after they die. Of course, we want to be with them a little bit longer, a lot longer. It's a very optimistic, hopeful thing, but I think the reason most people would tell you they believe in this stuff has nothing to do with near-death experiences or what the Bible says. It's just they want to see these people again. They want it to be true, so they end up believing it to be true. I hope Randall agrees with me on this. Most people have not looked at any evidence for this stuff one way or the other. They believe it because it makes them feel better. They want to believe it to be true.
I think that's fair in the same way that you clearly haven't looked at the evidence for the afterlife, and yet you
There's
have certain
no
beliefs
evidence
about it.
For the afterlife.
Right. Yeah. You just said that you hadn't looked at all those studies.
No, and yet I'd love to see what you got. But let's face it, if any of these studies were plausible, if they made any sense, they would be making a much bigger, they'd have a much bigger effect. The fact that it's so easy for other people who actually look at this stuff for a living to dismiss them doesn't make me think there's a lot to them. But again, like I said, I would love it if you could send me those, and maybe Justin can put them up on his site. Let's see what evidence there is.
I'm hoping to do a proper look, maybe across a couple of shows at some of these near-death experiences and studies and so on. You guys are split on whether there is evidence in the first place for these things, and okay, Hemant, if you going to have a look into it, great, and maybe feedback to us on that. But does the kind of the heaven that Randall's been painting there, which isn't fluffy clouds, basically glorified retirement home for a billion years, but is actually something that is somehow a continuation, but in a renewed sense, of all the things that make us human, cultural activity, progress, intellect, art, music, and everything, is that a kind of heaven you could get on board with, in a sense?
In other words, it's an extension of the stuff we have going on now.
Well, it's a perfection of the stuff we have going on now, I think, is the way that Randall's been...
I know what you're saying. I have a hard time just kind of imagining what that would even be like, because, I mean, I love my parents. My parents are alive, thankfully. We have a very good relationship. But, man, if I'm with them for more than a certain amount of time, we all get on each other's nerves, too.
Sure.
So... I mean, I have a hard time trying to imagine what perfection for everyone would be like because, for example, the stuff that I may like may directly contradict with something that Randall may like, and there's going to be conflict. I just don't understand this. Everything's going to be perfect for everybody that's there because at some point those things will butt heads.
Sure, sure. And I can understand Hemant's point here, Randall, because there is that sense of, well, in a way... just that the pleasures we do experience here on Earth are partly a factor of the fact that we experience pain. You know, I only appreciate that cold glass of water because I experience the discomfort of thirst, you know. So I'd be interested to hear from you how heaven can in any sense be a perfected state of existence and that doesn't kind of somehow neutralize our desires and so on.
Well, I hear a couple different things. From Hemant, I heard... the objection that if you put a bunch of people together, eventually they're going to start fighting.
Uh-huh.
And on that point, I would simply say, not when you have fully glorified people, people who no longer are liable to sin, who are morally perfect, who would never have those kinds of conflicts. So I think that issue can be readily dealt with. Now, Justin, on your issue, you raise some different points philosophically. They're philosophical points, such as, well, how could you have heaven without any hunger or without any thirst? Because don't those kinds of things, for example, enrich our experience of life? Isn't there some sense of degree of loss that can enrich our experience overall? And I actually have a couple chapters talking about those kinds of questions. I do think that there is room in our conception of heaven for things like being tired, being hungry, being thirsty, which could ultimately enrich our overall experience. One more thing I'll just drop in there. Hemant keeps coming back to this projection observation, but he's not presenting it as an argument. He's simply sort of stipulating because a person would really want something to be true, there's no reason to think it is true.
And no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that I think most people believe it because they want it to be true. That's not evidence for it or lack of evidence for it. I think that's just the way most people would think.
Well, of course, that's a truth claim that you'd have to defend with evidence.
From hearing what other people say, from talking to them. You're right. That's not evidence. That's anecdotal.
But,
that is the experience I've had when talking to people who talk about the afterlife.
I mean, I'd like to switch things maybe towards your view of what will actually happen, Hemant, at this point. Because as an atheist, you don't believe there's anything beyond the physical universe we live in. And what the physics tell us about the universe, and it's, Randall, again, has an interesting chapter sort of looking at, sort of taking you in a time machine and looking at, you know, where the Earth will be in 10,000 years, 100,000 years, a billion years. And he, you know, points out the obvious fact that going as it will currently run, the Earth will be swallowed up by the sun, and eventually everything will kind of peter out into a kind of cold, void, lifeless void of absolute zero, because that's just where the universe is heading as it expands ever further and further. Now, given that that is the ultimate destination, irrevocably so on atheism, does that ever cause you to ask what was the point of all of this?
No, it doesn't. I mean, that is what the science says is going to happen, more or less. It doesn't make my life any less meaningful or anything. It just means, wow, like, we have this conscience now. Like, we are alive. How amazing is that? How improbable is that? I think it just makes me cherish the life we do have all that much more. And I think saying, oh, if it all ends later, was there ever a point to it? I mean, anyone who's been in a relationship that didn't work out, and you ask yourself, well, would you rather have, you know, loved someone and lost it, or to never have loved it at all? Who would say, I wish I could take away all those emotions, all that life, because ultimately it's meaningless. It's like, no, you're here now, so enjoy it. I don't think it's meaningless to say, oh, if it's all going to end in a few billion years, then we might as well not have lived at all.
Yeah, so it's that sort of drink and eat now, for tomorrow we die, sort of. We make the best of life, though there's no ultimate destination or purpose to it.
Yeah, and in terms of the meaning, I mean, you make your own meaning of life, you give your life its own, whatever makes you happy, you can find your own meaning to life. It doesn't get cheapened by the fact that ultimately in billions of years we won't even be around to experience any of this.
Indeed. Randall, I mean, what were you trying to do in kind of painting that picture of taking us in a time machine and showing us the ultimate, rather depressing view of a universe that has simply run out of energy?
Well, I do begin that chapter by reflecting on H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine, which I read as a kid and was deeply impacted when the time traveler at the end, he gets into the time machine. He had been in the year 800,000 something. He goes on to the year 30 million AD. Of course, H.G. Wells was quite far off in his estimates, but in 30 million, he goes into the future and the Earth is, or the sun is this large red orb in the sky. All life on Earth is dead. The oceans have boiled away. And it's just this incredible existentially bleak picture, which left a big impact on me as a child. I don't think that I'm believing in an afterlife simply because that's the alternative, but I do think it's pretty nice that I have a different view, that I have a different picture. I like to think of it as, talk about what science says for the future. Science deals with all things considered. It doesn't deal with the intervention of agents. For example, if I talk about a fence in my backyard, what does science say will be the future of that fence? Well, the paint will eventually peel, the wood will rot, and it'll come down. Unless, of course, an agent, such as a homeowner, gets in the backyard every couple years, paints the fence, maintains it, puts nails in when it needs nails, and then it can stay up indefinitely long. A Christian would have a similar view of heaven and God, that God is going to intervene and he's going to restore and bring his creation to perfection. And I think it's a pretty glorious image.
Just quickly, we are running out of time in this section, but I remember Hemant watching a program presented by Stephen Hawking, the famous physicist, with my seven-year-old son. And my seven-year-old son got rather concerned at the fact that Hawking was describing exactly what Randall has described there, that the sun will one day envelop the Earth and so on, and the universe will kind of wind down and so on. And he looked at me and said, is that really going to happen, Dad? And I said, well, that's what science tells us will happen, but I believe God's going to do something to the universe before that happens. And I believe that's going to be the renewal of this whole universe we live in. Now, was I wrong to tell him that, do you think? Was I wrong to give him hope? Was I feeding him a fairy story?
That's a hard question to answer. I mean, I don't think it's a harmful thing to tell someone to have hope. I think we all do it all the time. We tell people things that may or may not be true because we want to make someone else feel better. So that's a situational thing. I don't really mind that so much. I get why people do that. But there's also a very different idea from giving someone hope like that to also saying, you better get right with Jesus, because if not, you're going to suffer for all of eternity. And when someone's dying, when someone's going through a rough time, we give them things to make them hopeful without realizing that the flip side of that is that, you know, if you don't buy into this, you're going to suffer. No one ever tells a cancer patient, you know, when you die, it'll all, they all say it'll all get better. No one ever says, hey, person who's about to die, you might go to hell.
Sure.
No one ever tells them that.
Yeah. We're going to conclude this conversation in just a moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, talking about heaven with atheist Hemant Mehta and Christian thinker Randall Rouser. Welcome back. I'm Justin Brierley, your host here on Unbelievable. Final part of today's program, and we'll be concluding the conversation I've been having with my guests Hemant Mehta and Randall Rouser on the issue of heaven. If you continue to listen through this afternoon, though, between 4 and 5, straight after today's program, you'll hear Lucinda Borkett-Jones. She's in conversation on The Profile with former MP, now a Lord, Paul Boateng. He's going to be talking about his Christian faith and how he's used that in the realm of politics, how it sustains him, about family life and more. So that's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And do come back again, of course, for Unbelievable at the same time next week between 2:30 and 4. You can find more details of today's programme and, of course, links to my guests at premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. And I'm so pleased to know that other people are championing the program all over the world. And I'm going to be playing out a little bit of a recent podcast by one Phil Vischer, who is, well, one of my heroes in terms of the comedy slash animation world. And I'll be explaining all when we get to today's feedback section. So that's all to come in a moment's time. Right now, let's finish up today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding this discussion on heaven between atheist Hemant Mehta and Christian thinker Randall Rouser, we've been talking about whether heaven and hell have been used as a sort of divine carrot and stick, whether there's any evidence for the afterlife. I did sort of end up that last section, Hemant, saying what I told my son when he said, Dad, are we really all going to just to be vaporized in the end by the sun and that sort of thing? And I said, no, I don't believe that's actually what's going to happen, that there will be an intervention. What would you tell your child in a given situation? What for you as an atheist gives hope, if you like, when we do consider our sort of ultimate existential end and meaning?
You know, if they straight up ask me if I believe in this stuff, I'll be honest with them, but more often, realistically, if they tell me they do believe in this, they believe in heaven, or they want to know where they go when they die, honestly, I feel like as a parent and as a teacher, I just kind of throw the question back at them. You know, what do you believe in? What do you think's going to happen? And if they say, I believe in heaven, I'm not going to try to tell them you're wrong. I think I might play devil's advocate, but I would hope I would play devil's advocate if they said, I don't think there's anything. Because I want them to just think about the question, and I don't want them to believe something just because I happen to believe that.
Mm. And obviously, as far as you're concerned, what happens when you die is it's lights out. You were conscious. You were no longer conscious.
Yeah, that is what I believe. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Randall. Obviously, you disagree fundamentally. You believe there are good reasons to believe that our conscious self is not something that is a purely physical phenomenon. We will be, as it were, resurrected as conscious beings in the life to come. Does it make a difference, do you think, to the way you live your life, you know, with the idea of eternity rather than that you are basically here and then gone?
Yes, you know, there's this line from the movie Gladiator, the things that we do in this life echo into eternity. And I think that for me, that is a sort of profound image to realize that when I look around myself, when I look around creation, I see things that God intends to bring to perfection in eternity. So talk, for example, about environmental concern. For me, environmental concern is about being a good steward to maintain the creation that God wants himself to restore. It's not about throwing it away. So that transforms my understanding of creation. Some of the practical issues, I think that this has implications. One chapter I talk about deaf people. There are many deaf people who look at things like cochlear implants that would basically heal people of deafness, if you want to use that term. They look at those as an imposition on their own culture. And I think that has been a really interesting thought to realize, could there be a place for deaf culture and deaf people in a resurrected creation? Now, those kinds of abstract questions have practical implications, because now it turns me around to realize with a greater degree of depth and appreciation some of the cultural goods in my midst in the world today, such as deaf culture. So I think exploring how God will redeem the world gets us looking at the good in the world in our midst now.
I suppose what that makes me think of is the fact that when the resurrected Jesus appeared, he still had the wounds in his hands, you know, that heaven is not necessarily a place where we're healed, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're kind of perfect human sort of specimens in some sense.
It is a fascinating detail in the Gospel of John that Jesus still has a wound in his side and still has the wounds in his hand. So I do have some time exploring that theologically. I think sometimes our views of the resurrection body have simply resulted in a bunch of Ken and Barbie dolls. You know, God's going to just create us all to look like these specimens that are all just perfect. And to me, that's a rather drab picture. I think there's amazing diversity in the world God created, and I expect that to be in the world he redeems.
Okay. For you, though, Hemant, is this all just sort of basically debating which way the twirl on a unicorn's horn goes kind of stuff?
Ultimately, debating the specifics of what the afterlife is like, it seems frivolous to me. I think it's a more interesting conversation to hear that evidence about why the afterlife is even there. And it's the same thing for religion, too. Like, I think it's a more interesting question about whether or not God exists, and less of an interesting question about what does God want us to do? Because that first question kind of makes that second one pointless if the answer is no. So, I don't get the... I think I'm with Randall. Like, those books about what if heaven is for real and what the near-death experience was like and somehow it leads to Jesus or whatever, those books are kind of frustrating to read or to talk about because it's so easy to debunk. And like Randall said, they've been debunked so many times. There's so many problems with those stories anyway. I am actually much more interested in this question of whether or not there's evidence of the afterlife through these papers or anything than
I am
with specifics.
Yeah. Well, it's been great to have you on. Thank you for coming on, Hemant, and putting up a feisty showing in this conversation with Randall. I have to confess, it would be sad if when we die and go to heaven that all the things we've enjoyed on earth were somehow simply mortal distractions, because there is something about our human activity that makes us as fully human. And one of the things I suppose think is all those books that I never got a chance to read, maybe I'll still get the chance to read them in the afterlife. Who knows?
Do you know there's a movie, Groundhog Day, with Bill Murray, where he keeps living the same day over and over again, and in that time he gets to become a concert pianist and learn different languages and so on. And, well, apart from the repetition, that gives us a little bit of image, I think.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, good to have you on. Thank you. Lots of food for thought in this new book by Randall, if you want to grab yourself a copy. What on earth do we know about heaven? RandallRouser.com is the website for Randall. You can find his musings generally on his blog and more details about the other books he's written there. FriendlyAtheist.com is the place to go for Hemant Mehta. And he's got certainly, you certainly had a book out, obviously, when you wrote the first one, Hemant. Have you had anything since or anything you'd like to point people towards?
Yeah, I wrote a book called The Young Atheist Survival Guide last year about kind of the obstacles that young atheists have to deal with and how we can all help them.
Okay, so another one that obviously you'll be able to link to from your blog. So friendlyatheist.com for Hemant Mehta. Gents, thanks both for being on the program today. Been a really interesting discussion. And it has inspired me to go and actually sort out, especially with this film coming out, some kind of a program looking at the evidence for near-death experiences. And who knows, perhaps we can have you on again when we do that. But for the moment, thanks very much for being my guests on today's show.
Hey, thanks for having us, and good talking to you, Hemant.
You too, Randall. Thank you, guys.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch. Last week's program provoked a flurry of emails. A lot of people wanted to talk about the issue of homosexuality, and so we'll get to some of that in a moment's time. Again, though, if you want to feedback on today's programme, leave your feedback on what both Randall and Hemant had to say about heaven, then do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or equally send me a text, a tweet, a Facebook. You can also phone in as well, 08456 52 52 52, and select the option for the voicemail for Unbelievable. As I say, we're going to get some of your feedback to that programme in a moment's time. First of all, though, I had the lovely experience of finding out that Unbelievable is being championed around the world, and I was shown in the direction of Phil Vischer's podcast. Phil Vischer is the man behind VeggieTales, Bob the Tomato, and Larry the Cucumber. And if you're not familiar with the evangelical Christian subculture, VeggieTales is a popular cartoon. My kids grew up on it, basically, telling Christian stories and so on through the eyes and ears of Bob and Larry and their friends. What I was to discover is that Phil has a great podcast himself. He's obviously interested, along with his co-hosts, in issues around apologetics and theology. Well, he and Sky were talking about Unbelievable, which they obviously recently discovered, to the other guest on their podcast, Christian. And this is some of what they had to say about Unbelievable.
Oh. Sky and I have a new favorite podcast.
You do?
That we want to tell you about.
Ooh, yeah, I can't wait to hear
plug
this.
Another okay. podcast. On
okay. Better get the bell ready.
Second favorite podcast, because this is our favorite podcast, because it's ours.
If we listen to it.
But there's a Christian radio network in the UK called Premier UK Christian Radio, and I've been on it, actually. I was in London right. a couple of years ago and did an interview with Premier UK.
There's like seven listeners, right?
No, it's all over the UK, and there's Christians left in the UK.
There are?
What are you saying? What are you saying?
I heard it's a very small number, though.
There's John Lennox and Alistair McGrath. There's all the big apologists.
Right, N.T. Wright.
N.T. Wright mm-hmm. and E. Stott, except he's no longer with us. Mm-hmm. And Polkinghorne, Sir John Polkinghorne. Anyway, there's a radio show. It's on Premier UK Radio, and it's called Unbelievable.
Yeah,
question
unbelievable.
Mark.
Unbelievable.
Good, good. Two dings for Unbelievable, and it's hosted by a young guy out there. But he takes huge issues, huge questions of the day, and then he invites top experts in to debate them. And so they're like, I listened to one, which is a debate on Old Testament morality between a progressive rabbi, a conservative evangelical Old Testament scholar, and Richard Dawkins, the atheist.
Wow,
and
I bet that was interesting.
The three of them on this radio show for an hour and a half. They're an hour and a half long. And there was another one. There's an hour and a half with N.T. Wright on his new book about Paul and taking questions in from viewers and just or listeners and answering all those questions. I listened to another one that was Stephen Meyer, the intelligent design expert, debating an evolutionary biologist on the Cambrian explosion.
I heard that one.
That was interesting.
Yeah, I don't even know what the Cambrian explosion is.
I actually listened to that one
when
while
Cambria
I was walking,
exploded.
While I was walking
Cambria?
On Cannon Beach.
Really? Yeah. You listen to that
I
one?
I listened to that while I was walking Cannon Beach.
Which is where the Goonies were filmed.
Yes, it is.
So here's what both Sky and I had the same reaction. You can find it on iTunes. It's a radio show in the UK, but now they're putting the shows up on iTunes. So look for Unbelievable on iTunes and you'll find it. Both of us said, why isn't anything like this on Christian radio in America?
And the answer was?
There isn't a good answer.
I think it's because there's still that fear-based stuff of venturing out with people that disagree with us.
Well, what's fascinating is the way they do the program. The moderator, Justin, I forget his last name, is very fair to the atheists right. that come on. It isn't, right. it isn't, let's get an atheist on here so we can trash them. It's very respectful dialogue. It's intelligent dialogue. There's disagreements, but it's not... It isn't like these atheists come on here because they're going to get trashed.
Right.
So
there's like a gazillion episodes up, and I was scrolling back through them. I was like, oh, I want to listen to that one, too. Yeah. Oh, I want to listen to that one, too. Oh, that guy, he's on there? That's crazy.
And I'd say what
we get is praise music. That's what
there's
Christian,
a place for that. I don't want to
yeah,
totally dismiss
there's a place
it.
For praise music in church.
So back to the podcast.
My point being, go check out the podcast. If you like to wrestle with issues, if you don't mind hearing someone who disagrees with you defending their position vociferously, And even if you do, just knock it off and go listen to the podcast anyway.
Can you talk to me real quick about that first podcast you talked about?
Unbelievable question mark.
With Richard Dawkins.
It was interesting to listen because he had a progressive rabbi, you know, and then an evangelical OT scholar that both kind of pushed back on him really hard on how selective he was being in his reading of the Old Testament to draw the conclusions that he draws. And he actually kind of admitted that, yes, he was, but that he does that because he has a famous line in his book, The God Delusion, where he describes God based on his reading of the Old Testament. And it's with every negative adjective you could think of, you know, just all strung together. And when they actually pushed him on that, said, you're really, that's a very selective reading to come up with that list. He said, well, actually, I use that line to get a laugh when I do speaking. You know, it's I know it's not accurate. He didn't. But that's kind of what he was saying. It's not accurate, but it gets a laugh, and it's a good way to start a conversation. So it's intentionally provocative to say, which was kind
of
interesting.
As I've listened to a number of those episodes now of Unbelievable, it's interesting to hear from different atheists because some are very provocative. They're really not being fair or balanced in their representation of faith. They're just they're very gifted rhetorically at making a point. And then there are others who are, frankly, far more
thoughtful.
They're more thoughtful and they're fair, and it goes the other way too with some Christians that they'll give points at times to the other side to say, yeah, you have a really good point there. That so it all depends on what the dynamic is and who the two people are debating.
And so do you feel it's like messy. Listening to those and listening to that other side helps you better understand where an atheist is coming from and how to be more understanding and compassionate? What's the value of that for you?
Well, the value is to hear both sides. There's always a value in hearing both sides because otherwise you just assume that your position is the only reasonable, rational position and that anyone who disagrees is obviously doing it because they're evil.
Okay.
Well, I hope you'll forgive my vanity for playing that out, but it was so gratifying to hear that Unbelievable is making its mark in other podcasts around the world. And a big thank you to Phil, Christian, and Sky for letting their audience know about it. And as a way of returning the favor, do of course go and subscribe yourself if you're a podcast subscriber to the Phil Vischer podcast. I have philvischer.com if you want more information. Let's go to some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. First of all, thank you to those who have reacted with delight that Unbelievable the Conference is returning in July this year. July the 12th is the date you need to ring fence in your diary at Westminster Central Hall in London. We have some stunning speakers coming along to this year's conference and a fabulous partnership for it too. All the details and the booking will be made available in February. So hold on for that. But thanks particularly to Chris, who said, it is of no concern to me whether the conference clashes with the Soccer World Cup or not. Last year, it clashed with a test match. Now, that is bad planning. Thank you very much, Chris. I hope that either way, you'll be able to make the conference this year. And yes, it doesn't clash with the World Cup because there are no matches being played during the day on Saturday, the 12th of July, just to reiterate. Mark, thank you for getting in touch as well from Abingdon in Maryland, USA. You say, I enjoy your show immensely. Had to share a funny thing that happened recently. I was on my way home from work listening to one of your older programs, UFOs, Aliens and God. A few seconds after merging onto a major highway, a white van passed me and it had all sorts of things spray painted on it. Graffiti. What caught my eye was that on the back of the van, the letters UFO were painted largely on the lower right corner. I laughed out loud and said something to the effect, that's a good one, God. A few seconds later, as I got closer to the van, I noticed that written in smaller letters over UFO were the words Jesus saves. That really cracked me up, and it just seems too much for a simple coincidence. Keep doing what you're doing. God bless. Thank you, Mark, for getting in touch. Edward Cullum wants to get in touch, and we're going in now into some of the emails, many of them there were, in relation to last week's show, which was Ed Shaw and Justin Lee talking about homosexuality, gays, the gospel and the church. Do you have to be celibate? Is that the best response to biblical Christianity? Ed Shaw has chosen to remain celibate as a same-sex attracted Christian. Justin Lee is open to committed gay relationships. Here's Ed. He says, I was interested to hear that. I've battled with being gay for many years. I'm 48 years old and have had periods of suppression of my sexuality and also lived in a gay relationship for 16 years, including being in a civil partnership for for 8 years. In the last year or so, I have strived to reject a homosexual life. I'm currently attending a church regularly in Manchester and want to leave the gay lifestyle for good. It may sound hypocritical to some, but I believe that God wants me to do this, and I know he's supporting me. I've never felt so sure that his Holy Spirit is leading me to defeat this lifestyle. I've never ever been really happy being gay, and was most happy when I married a woman in 1993. Sadly, that never worked out, and despite my honesty to my wife about my battle, she was too young to cope with it. I know that only belief in God can save me into a life of real value, self-respect, and most important, an intimate relationship with God. Thank you very much, Ed, for sharing your story. This is Anne, says, Ed spoke in favour of being celibate, even though he's attracted to men, whereas Justin believed that as a gay person, he needn't be celibate. However, apart from the homosexual element, the Bible states that fornication, sex outside marriage, is wrong. Even for straight people. It clearly says that Christians shouldn't have sex before marriage. So on that basis alone, homosexuals shouldn't have sex before marriage because it is fornication. How can one argue against that, whatever their orientation? And Gemma says, Ed and Justin have been very respectful to each other. I must say, I believe Ed's views are correct and in line with the Bible. We have to remember all scripture is God-breathed and he doesn't change. The eternal consequences of practicing homosexuality are very clear, can't be misinterpreted, however much we try and fit them to be in line with our society. And Bethan in Doncaster says, I'm a woman. My boyfriend and myself have been together for several years and would very much like to be married. However, as we're both divorced, we're currently seeking the Lord over this. In the meantime, we share our lives totally chastely, despite having healthy libidos. Would this not be an option for a homosexual? To live a life devoid of a close companion can be very hard. However, living chastely would not preclude that companionship, says Bethan. Gabriel sent me a link to his blog, Streamlets into Deep. I'm going to only read a little bit of this, Gabriel, but you say as part of this, when I was a young man, I was introduced to the world of pornography by way of a bra advert in a magazine. I didn't know what to do with it, but the person introducing me to pornography did. Is that not a fair picture of some of our learning? Mercy. Please know, I'm under no delusion that I would have avoided pornography altogether had this opportunity not shown itself, but this marks the beginning for, as most I know, of my own self-awareness of sexual orientation. What was available to me in my person to deal with that opportunity? For the sake of time and attention, I'll spare you the rest of the story, but I need to make it clear. The way I explored my sexual orientation was not ideal. It wasn't even close to anything an individual who wants to form into a thoughtful, caring and loving person would willingly add to their person. And what was formed over the next 2 months would take over the next decade and more to deform. When I observe people exploring sexual orientation, I tend not to find them thinking of the way we've all formed into who we are. By looking back at age 17 for me, I can tell you my formation as a heterosexual male included gross reductions of the gender I was attracted to. While being sexually attracted to females, I had picked up a culture where sexual activities portrayed as all for me. I was the centre of my universe while remaining not merely a sexual being. Before I go on, please know the main point here isn't my struggle over humanising females while I deformed the habits I picked up as a young man. My main point here is superficial treatment of how young men and women form as people with a heterosexual orientation may likely foster superficial thinking in the formation of young men and women who experience homosexual orientation. So it's not simple, says Gabriel. Helen wants to say, I've learnt in psychology classes that both homosexuality and bisexuality are caused by chemicals in the womb environment. As people therefore can't help being gay, and it's not a choice they've made, but it's thrust on them, like autism is, I think the church should accept it as part of the fall of man. Gays should not be told they must be celibate for life. Instead, they should be celibate while dating another gay person and reserve gay sex for gay marriage, which is now legal. We've no right to inflict celibacy on them, as heterosexuals have the right to choose it, and so therefore so should gays. And you make the case that in Paul's time, the behaviour he condemns is married men having sex on the side with boy slaves. This, I believe, was what Paul was quite rightly condemning. These married men were not born gay, and the boys they used were used by them as sex slaves. It was paedophilia. I don't believe Paul was condemning the few people who were born gay due to the chemical environment in their mother's womb. Okay, that's Helen's point of view. Graham is a skeptic. He says, Justin, and as in Justin Lee, started the discussion by describing the explanations that fellow believers gave for his same-sex attraction, domineering mother, abandonment, etc. I think he showed how inadequate those explanations were. I was disappointed that Ed didn't respond to what I think is a fundamental question. Why does God create gay people? I'm assuming Ed doesn't believe that being gay is a choice and that it's not a psychological condition that can be cured. I respect Ed's decision to be celibate, but if God makes people who love people of their own sex, what is so wrong with the physical act of love, says Graham. Well, I can't speak for Ed, obviously, but my suspicion is he might say actually something not dissimilar to Helen there, in terms of we are part of a sort of fallen creation, and so we all have, you know, aspects of our life and sexuality that are not as perhaps they would be in a perfect world. Though I don't think he would go along, obviously, with Helen's solution to that. He believes that it is part of the sacrifice one makes in a Christian life not to take part in sexual relationships in that sense. Lots of others as well who wanted to chime on this. Let's get Mary says, it was interesting to hear the two views on this programme, but I kept shouting at the radio, let's look at the Bible verses. I thought I'd send my email to you. Where you have two Bible-believing Christians coming to different conclusions, wouldn't it be good and helpful to get them to share Bible verses and explain their understanding of them and how they sustain their different viewpoints? Mary, I appreciate totally that we didn't get into a lot of the Bible issues in that programme. It was more a sort of conversation on their experiences and so on. But we have done those shows. So if you go to the Unbelievable Archives at premier.org.uk/unbelievable, you will find plenty of past shows where we do dig into the biblical issues. There are more here, but no time to bring them as we're running fast out of time. Thanks for all of these interesting responses to the programme. Sorry we haven't got time for more. And of course, we'll have more time for your feedback at the same time next week. Do make sure you come back for Unbelievable. Let me tell you what's going on. You're unbelievable. The Church of England recently released a report on areas of growth in the church in the UK and areas of decline. Interestingly, there's been growth among the so-called Fresh Expressions movement, churches meeting in cafes, pubs, and doing interesting experiments with church. Well, we'll be looking at that through the eyes of both Christians and sceptics next week. Don't have a lot of detail at this point because I'm still working on it, but that is going to hopefully be the topic of next week's programme. Hope you can join me for that. Do stick around here, though, on Premier Radio this afternoon for the Profile interview coming next with Lord Paul Boateng. For now, I'm Justin Brierley. Thanks for being with me on the programme today.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint or stain project, saving is at the top of your to-do list. Save now with buy one, get one half off select paints, stains, and primers from top brands like Valspar, HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams, and Cabot via Visa gift card rebate. Find more Memorial Day deals now at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 5/15 through 5/28.